Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm John Marzalek, a host for the new podcast, Voices of the Queer South. Today, we'll be talking to Maurice Ardoin about his new memoir, Stone Motel, Memoirs of a Cajun Boy, published by University Press of Mississippi. I think that one of the reviewers of Stone Motel, Frank Perez, said it well when he said that Stone Motel is much more than a memoir. It is a meditation on the intersection of place and identity. Ardoin elevates the classic coming-of-age story to an art form with authenticity and wisdom, all the while never wandering too far from his Cajun roots. Maurice, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to talk to you today. I wondered if we could begin by you telling us about yourself.
Well, I live in Manhattan and in Cornwallville, New York, in upstate in the mountains of New York. I come from a large family, and I was one of nine children, the middle. And in my career, I've always been working in public relations in the nonprofit sector, where I've worked in higher education, in healthcare, and issues like immigration, asylum. In my heart, I've always been a writer. So I've been writing this whole time, not necessarily on the same thing, not on this book, but bits and pieces over the years. And now that I have actually put a book together, I've discovered the joy and I need to continue pushing myself to actually focus and write things that are actually intentional. So that's what I'm hoping
to do. That's great. Yeah, that's great. Well, how did you come to write Stone Motel?
I like that question. I actually started writing my grandmother's biography. I had interviewed her over the years many times on tape and just taking notes as an old-fashioned reporter would do. So I had a lot of information on her, and she was a fascinating person. So I thought I was going to write a book called Hortense, which was her first name. So I started writing bits and pieces. One of the first things I wrote is now a chapter in my memoir, and that's the chapter called Chilled Lanyap, which means, Lanyap means in Cajun, it's something extra, a little surprise. So that's one of the chapters. It takes place at her house a lot. It's about her really very specifically. And there are other chapters in the book that are about her that came from those conversations I had with her, as did other chapters come from other conversations I had with other people in my life. So it really started out with that years and years ago. And then and most recently, in the last few years, when this book started coming out, I mentioned earlier that I lived in New York City, but also in upstate New York in the mountains. The mountains is where I would do most of my writing. And that's where I would take staycations and intensely write. Yes, I would get up at 4:30 in the morning and I would write and write. My goal was write from, you know, have a coffee and start writing with a fresh brain every day on my staycation. Took me a day or
two. Wow.
Yeah, so I did that for over the course of about 2 or 3 years of all staycations. I would take a vacation on occasion to go somewhere, but mostly my time off was spent up here in the house where I am right now. And so I started focusing. What I did not do as a writer was make an outline and a plan. I did not know this book would turn out the way it did. I just let it come out. So it was more organic than structured in the beginning. And then I started looking at what I had and going, oh, okay, I need to make this way. So I'm building it around what I saw, and then taking things out and then realizing I should add other things. So it was a process.
It's a beautiful book. I couldn't put it down as I read it. And I have so many questions to ask you, but you mentioned the chapter on Lanyap, and that was such a poignant story for me. I wonder if you could tell that story of when you go with your grandmother, who I believe you called Ma Mère?
Mama, yeah. In Ville Platte, I was born and raised in a town called Eunice, which is about 30 miles away from Ville Platte. Ville Platte in French is flat town. My grandmother's town, Ville Platte, most people there spoke French as their primary language, as did my parents. Mm. So all of my elders, French, for them, French was the first language and English was second. And my grandmother's language, the English was very broken. What she learned, and I mentioned that in the book, she came off from watching TV. She really didn't have any formal education in English at all her entire life. So that story is one day, it's a flashback. It's a lot of my chapters have flashbacks within flashbacks. This is a story where I was coming of age. I had just gotten a new car. It was new to me. It was old, a Volkswagen Beetle. And I wanted to go my first trip to my grandmother's house. I started going before I got my own car. I had my license, so my mother would let me use her car. And I'd go visit my grandmother, go hang out with her, go take her driving around. So this story follows a couple of days, different incidents, visiting my grandmother. And I brought my sister Gilda with me, that first one in the blue Volkswagen, because she comes running out the house when she saw me drive up with my new little car and said, I want to drive. I said, I just started driving myself. I haven't had much time myself. Well, come with me to my mom's and I'll let you drive. You got a deal. So she comes with me and we both go. And she brings her Ovation guitar. And Ovation is a very high-end, beautiful 12-string guitar that has a lot of richness to it. And my grandmother was a music freak. She loved music, not only Cajun music, but anything musical. And she played the accordion herself. And she also played things like the violin and she would beat on drums. Mm. She was very, very musical. And she loved it when any of us played. So my sister Gilda brings her guitar. We show up. She kind of knew we were coming. I think we might have placed a call into her. But my grandmother didn't go very far, even if she was not home. We knew that she'd be in the neighborhood. So we drive up, and she wasn't in her house. So I walked over to the neighbors, and sure enough, she was there, and they were rattling off in French. Madame Hedley. Yeah, so they were they were very good friends. And so that story starts off with that incident of driving to Ville Platte with my sister is kind of in the middle of the story. It starts off with one of my grandma's typical close friends is her sister-in-law, my grandfather Dejean. We called him Papa. Yeah, he was Papa, and my grandma was Mama. So Papa's sister Estelle, we grew up calling her Titelle. We'd say her name is Tante Titelle because that's how you'd say it in Cajun. So. I start off with that chapter with Tante Tell has plastic curtains because it struck me her house was really old, ramshackle. It was the Deep South, so it didn't get terribly cold. But if we had if they had winters like we do here in the mountains in New York, it wouldn't have survived. You'd have froze to death. That house was so drafty. Mm. So it was a little old wooden shack of a house on a gravel road, and I was struck. I was a kid, maybe 10. Before I went driving, I struck at how simple she lived and how unneedy she was. She would wear big billowing house dresses and she had giant corroded feet and she would smoke. She'd roll her own cigarettes. She had hair going in all directions. Mm-hmm. She was an amazing character. And I, of course, little boy, I wasn't recording this. I was writing it down, though. I started making notes when I was about 10, maybe 12.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I've been a little reporter most of my life. So this chapter, Chul Lanyap, it talks about things that surprise you. And it has a few incidences in this chapter. I'm not going to give it all away, but a few incidences where Gilda and I or my ma finds things that surprise her. We all find little surprises throughout the story. And so it's always a good thing when you find a surprise. Sometimes it's a surprise that saddens you when you realize what the backstory of that particular surprise, and that's that happens in the story. And sometimes you go, you keep going on a daily. When you're in a person's daily life, they're just perfectly fine and normal. But as an observer, sometimes I was struck by how unusual it was that a person like Tante Tel and my grandmother Hortense lived so simply, like I said, without needs. And I when I wrote that story, that was the very first story I think I mentioned earlier that ended up in the book. I wrote that when I still lived in New Orleans. And it changed when I got to writing the book and I realized I want to use that particular story. I rewrote it because I didn't write the same way anymore. But the story stayed the same as far as the gist of it. And that is that life is full of little surprises that if we look for them or you don't look for surprises, you let them happen. You can appreciate them. They teach you all kinds of things.
And you just do a wonderful job in the book of telling us the story through the eyes of a child or whatever age you were at the time. It struck me how you did that so well. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about your relationship with your mamère, because the stories about her and you were just beautiful.
Thank you. My grandmother in the book is my savior. In fact, I almost dedicate the book to her. In my soul, I do. But on paper, I dedicated the book to the dog who was with me most of the time while I was writing the book. He's no longer with us. His name was Moby. And I would write all day, like I said, from 4 till sometimes, definitely till noon. That was my goal. But sometimes till 9 at night, I wouldn't quit. And so Moby would be my ears. I would read back as I wrote. As a writer, you know, John, that once you read something aloud, you hear things, you see things differently. And go, oh, wait, that doesn't sound right. Let me rewrite that paragraph. So Moby was my ears for that. Anyway, so I dedicated the book to him. But my grandmother really is the person this book is about. And it really you could see where the story of her life could come out of this book. In fact, I'm thinking of actually following up this book with a biography. But it would be kind of fictionalized because I didn't get to finish interviewing her. There were a lot of things I would like to have finished asking her. And she died at 96. And I had moved away to New Orleans. And so I wasn't as close. I couldn't finish that process. And I thought, oh, I'll go back one day and do it. And of course, you never do that. So that lesson is do what you have while people are in your life. Make sure you can fully avail yourself of what they have to bring to your life. So I wish I had done more with my grandmother. And I think I would have written the biography and would have been, I think, quite rich because she was so much more interesting than anything fiction. So my relationship with her was started as a very young age. When I was like 6 or 7, I was at when my papa was still alive, he treated me as a traiteur. Traiteur is a faith healer in Louisiana. And traiteurs are not just unique to Louisiana. They're all over the Deep South. And but Louisiana has had a lot of them when I was little because of the culture there, the combination of the Creole culture and the Cajun culture. The Creoles in particular brought faith healing from the islands below the United States. Yeah, that's what the Creoles migrated into Louisiana from the South up, and then the Cajuns migrated into Louisiana from the North down. We came from Canada. Huh. Yeah, so the Creoles and Cajuns blended, and what was common to those two groups, very different types of people, but what was common was the French language. So that was a natural way to start building. I mean, people say, oh, Louisiana, it's Cajun with the Creole accent or Creole with a Cajun flavor. Like, that doesn't kind of make literal sense because there are two very distinct cultures. But when you talk about Louisiana, you say Louisiana does involve Creoles and Cajuns and Americans. There's a lot of people who settled in Louisiana who were settlers from other parts. The people with names like Smith and Jones are in Louisiana like they are in every out. So my relationship with my grandma started very, very young, and I realized early on that she was kind of my safe place. I felt that very early on, and her husband was that too. I started the story about him being a faith healer. I was crippled over in pain. I had a lot of stress. I was feeling from a young age. I was when I was 6 or 7 when that first incident happens with my grandfather. I wasn't yet the middle child. I was one of the youngest children because my other siblings weren't born yet. So, but I was, I would go and I would get to my grandparents' house and have such a feeling of welcome, of these arms, you know, encircling me and hope holding me that I did not get in my family. Because even as the sixth born child, or the fifth born child, I had a lot of competition for attention at home. But not when I was at my grandparents' house. At my grandparents' house, I was the star. I would go and there, it's all about me. So I kind of love that. So it started early on. And she, my grandmother, I'll try to cut this short. My grandmother stayed with me as my protector and my savior throughout this story. She helped me get through some hardships that we'll maybe talk about later. Or there was things going on that were just beginning as I was a child that I realized that I wasn't completely, I didn't know how to even enunciate what was going on with me. But I was beginning to feel that I was not necessarily in a safe place. And my grandmother took me. And when my parents, my father was very, very violent. My mother was very, very overwhelmed. She had at that point six mm-hmm. kids, and she only had nine. And she had her own business. They were both entrepreneurs. So running my parents' motel and her beauty shop took everything out of both of them. And he, on my father, on top of all that, had PTSD, which wasn't even named at the time as a condition. People came back from World War II and just had to be, a solid, stoic, keep it to yourself kind of thing. That's how they dealt with that kind of thing back then. So, and he had issues. So I was beginning to feel the effects of his PTSD as a child. And so that's where the story goes, I'll follow through. But anyway, so that's why she was so important to me. She latched onto me, I latched onto her, and she kept me through my adulthood until she died. We were very tight.
Yeah, and it really comes through in the book. And I wondered if you thought that your connection with your grandmother, part of it was because of course, when you were a kid, you didn't realize this, but part of it was because that you were gay.
Yeah, she recognized, I would go to her house and I'd be myself. It was the first time I could be myself. And I would put on her, I mentioned this in the book, old lady face powder all over myself. And she and I would dance because, you know, Louisiana is the land of Mardi Gras and all the joie de vivre, that music is an indigenous kind of music, again, derived from the Cajuns and the Creoles. That kind of everyday joy celebrated with food and music. And so I got to her house and that was all about that. She had an old phonograph. She had those old 78 records playing. And all that we call it chanka chank music, because if you listen to it, if you're kind of not really paying attention in the background, Cajun music sounds chanka 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 chanka. It has that. So we call it chanka chank. And so that's what was going on. And so she put me in a world, not only where I was a star, but where we could sing and dance and not be self-conscious about anything.
Yes. And the freedom you felt really shines through in those stories.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You kind of alluded to this, but at different places in the book, you share some of the abuse that are a lot of abuse that you faced from your father. And I wondered what that was like for you to write about this as an adult, because it was obviously, it was painful just to read that.
Thank you. I'll give the listeners a little bit of primer on the abuse. My father, and it doesn't give anything away, it is in the blurbs if you read the book jacket. My father was attacking me early on as a very young preteen. He didn't attack me when I was six, but I could feel his hostility. The energy was apparent even as that child, that young. But he didn't start actually hitting me until I was about 10 or 11. He did not like that I was sassy. That was his veiled word for a little gay boy. He would be very forceful about, you know, you have to be a man. And here I am 11. So he already started trying to recondition me to be like him and my older brother Andy. Both of them loved to go hunting and fishing and doing all that stuff. And I did not know how to be a boy, which was hard for me because I really felt lost. And I remember that identifying that issue, not knowing how to be a boy. I didn't know I wasn't a girl, but I did not know how it wasn't as that's what I was assigned, basically. And I was like, OK, I could never figure it out. So I was like, I don't know how to deal with this man who's not really accepting me. And so he violently attacked me one day in one of the chapters. I keep it to a minimum in the book because I don't want to make the readers flee. But he attacked me really violently once after we had lost the motel. The motel burned in a fire on Christmas, a week before Christmas. We lost everything. And the struggle, my parents were typical parents. They kept it from us as much as possible about how dire the financial situation was, because that was our bread and butter. And my mother had a beauty shop, thank God, because that's what kept us fed while the motel was being rebuilt. Half of the motel stayed up, but the half of it burnt down to the ground, and the half that stayed up was really smoke damaged for weeks and weeks and weeks before we could just get a few of the rooms rentable, because the customers kept coming. We had a loyal following. So slowly we built back up the business, and within a year, new rooms were built to replace the ones that had burned. So we got back on our feet, but during that process, my father was very, very, very stressed on top of his own background, which I talk about in the book, having been as a child himself when he was about 14. His father had remarried. His mother, his biological mother, had died in childbirth. He was one of 14 children. And so at 14, he was left to, and two of his brothers were left to live on the neighbor's, in the neighbor's barn, because the former next to my grandfather's farm went over to him and said, "You have a lot of children. I need help on my farm. If they come and work with me, they can live with me, and I'll feed them and I'll make sure they get to school." And so my father and two of his brothers went to live in a barn and worked every day from sun up to time to go to school and then right after school. So they did that for a couple of years before they entered the war. So he was a very young boy, basically at 14, learning how how hard life was. It was during the Depression and years after. And then he goes into the war, and then he's 18. He sees all this bloodshed, and there's a lot of trauma in his young life. And then he comes back to Louisiana and gets married and starts having kids. So that's not a whole lot of long time before he's trying to function as a stable adult, and some of these things start seeping through to his shell. He had a very tough man, tough outer shell, but they started seeping through. So that kind of was also coloring how he was seeing me. He saw this soft little boy. He used that word soft a lot with me. He never called me contemporary names like faggot or queer. He would call me, he would say soft. He would say, you need to be more like a man. You need to, there's a chapter called Men Folk in the book about how he used that term. He said, this one needs to grow up and join the men folk. And it was a dagger for me. I knew what that meant. I knew what he was trying to say. It still chokes me up. All of that was going on in him. And I, at that time, did not know how much of the trauma he had experienced. So I would just assume he was just me. And so I got through that period with the help of my grandmother. She saw it happening. My mother tried to be as good of a mother as she could be, but she had a business to run. We had that motel that we had to rebuild, and a lot going on. And I was one of nine. Ultimately, she had four babies after me. So she had a lot going on. So my grandmother, thank God for her. So to answer your question, when I'm writing about that, it wasn't as easy. Believe me, it was. I didn't expect to write about it at all. When I was writing the book, setting out to write it, I thought I was going to focus on my grandmother. But you can't tell my grandmother's story without talking about her grandchildren, and I'm one of those, and I would have come up. So as I'm writing it, I realized this is my story. I have to tell that piece of it. And it's something I had put back in my mind and gotten through. My grandmother's advice to me all those years up until she died was, and try to imagine yourself on the other side of a problem. Try to put yourself, envision what's coming next. The good thing that's on the other side of this. I mean, when you go through some dark spots in your life, My grandfather, the traiteur, that was kind of like how traiteurism, faith healing works. You have to, there's prayers, but you have to, he has to calm you down and help you relax as a patient. And then he wants you to try to envision, it's through faith and through believing and spirituality and becoming something that is not your everyday self, getting away from your everyday self and lifting away from that. And trying to put yourself on the other side, and it works to a certain degree. It worked for me. It worked for my siblings and my mother. I saw him. I was there when he treated other siblings, and I knew that worked. So my grandmother took that to heart and used it with me when my grandfather was long gone. So I writing about that piece of it was wonderful. Telling that story about how I experienced that. But then you have to deal with why are you going through this? Why are you having to envision yourself going on the other side? So those parts were hard to write. And I wouldn't write another memoir that way again. Any memoir. I think that because you have to dig so deep and you have to scratch things that have long healed and you think, or you reopen those wounds and think, oh, I don't know if I really want to do this. So there are times when I thought, just write something else, just jump on another part of the story. So, because I do want the listeners to understand, my story is full of fun too. There's good stuff in there. So I want to make sure that because the impetus for writing this book, for me, a lot of it was I wanted to leave something behind to the my nieces and nephews, grandchildren of them, you know, a lot of the generations to come, about what it was like to be living in those times. That also my grandparents, I wanted them to know them, and my parents, I wanted them to know what it was like, and the smells and sounds and tastes of Louisiana at the time, because after the 1970s, the 1980s started happening, and everything started changing in that culture. So my book, really, I wanted it to be a record of those things that I experienced. And it, you know, it turned into a memoir. Not intentionally, it just happened.
Well, and you talk about this, as you say, this unique culture, this unique area of the country that hasn't been talked about a lot. I don't know. Can you talk a little bit more, you know, give the listener a description of what that was like living there and what that culture was like?
Yeah. I'll give you an example of how distinct it was to me. After I left it, I didn't realize how pronounced it was as a cultural cultural influences. I mentioned the food, the music, the fact that so many families have at least one or two musicians within the family, not professional, but everybody has an instrument. And there are a lot of professional musicians coming out of Louisiana. That music has been recorded and played all over the world, and a lot of traveling, the Cajun and Zydeco music. Louisiana is also the birthplace of jazz, as you know. So that kind of joie de vivre, the Epicurean approach to life, it's almost hedonistic. You love life, you enjoy it while you have it. And so life should be beautiful. Life should be full of smells that are wonderful and sounds and tastes. And so you should make as much beauty in the world as possible. And that includes how you eat, what you, how you celebrate, how you worship. All those things were very animated to me. But really, I didn't realize how intense it was until I left and I go out of Louisiana and I lived in New Orleans after I left Cajun land. I lived in New Orleans. New Orleans is a very different part of the state. But then I moved to New York and I went, wait a minute, where's the spice? Where the music on every corner of New Orleans. New Orleans is a wonderful city for music. And you go, any neighborhood has a juke joint somewhere or some place where live music is happening. Virtually every single neighborhood in that city. And a lot of cities have music scenes, but they're isolated to a section of downtown somewhere. Like if you go to Austin, there's a great section of Austin on 6th Street where everything is happening. And it kind of then peters out. But in New Orleans, it's everywhere. And I think you lived in New Orleans, right, John?
I did.
Yeah, so
yeah, in the Marigny section, yeah.
You got to experience that. It's very much part of the everyday culture, very European in many ways, in that
life
slows down intentionally. And so that's what I grew up with. And someone was talking to me a few weeks ago about that culture and being a gay boy in that culture and having that kind of the oppression of the time, the 1970s, we're going through a resurgence of some of that hostility now with our rights, and some of the things we're seeing now in the world are ugly, and thinking, whoa, these times aren't as evolved as I would hope they'd be by now. But anyway, back in the 70s, all that misogyny, all that bigotry, all that was more pronounced than it ever than it is now by far. But still, the question was, how did I fit into that kind of world? Well, that was kind of that was the atmosphere. Well, Louisiana, go back to that thing. Louisiana is the home of Mardi Gras. There was always something to look forward to. And there was always a party. There was always, there were costumes. We knew drag before drag was, you know, a thing. It wasn't just for gay men. You'd get in your Mardi Gras drag and you were partying as a child. So that's part of the flavor of our lifestyle. And it still is. And again, you mentioned this earlier, that it's a snapshot of that time period of the 70s, because again, by the 1980s, think of what was happening in the 1980s. Cable television started becoming widely available. That changed what we were exposed to. Fast food became widely available. That changed what we ate. Microwave oven kind of came into households. Microwaves didn't come into the households in full force until about early 80s. They were invented well before that, I think in the 50s, I don't know. But they became affordable, accessible to the masses in the early 80s. So everything was changing all at once. Those things that really we take for granted. So back in those days, people look at the state of Louisiana today. It's one of the most obese per capita states there is. It's not the fattest state in the union, but it's one of the top. And people go, it's all that rich food. Well, no, it's not. That rich food has always been part of Louisiana, but we didn't eat it every single day. We didn't have access to it. You would make a big old jambalaya. Right. You wouldn't eat that every day. You would kill yourself. So now, because of exposure, because of instant access, because of so many things, our culture has changed since then. We have that culture in many places. When I moved to New York City. You didn't see a lot of that kind of problem. Morbid obesity in itself. I use that as one of the points because there are many other points that, about changing the culture with television and the advent of technology that made everything easier for us. So when I moved to New York in 1992, it was odd to see anybody who was really oversized, a larger than the average person. Mm-hmm. The average person now, the size of, we have all become bigger. Our average is now bigger than it was in 1992 as Americans.
Well, Morris, I remember in your book, if you look at some of this is great pictures you include in the book, and you show pictures of your family and your grandparents, and everyone's skinny in those pictures.
Yeah, because with all that excess, with all that epicurean, I'm talking about all that joie de vivre we had, we weren't doing it in excess. So it was a great culture, but we did organically modulate. It wasn't just a bacchanal. It was something we did. Like when you make a big gumbo, gumbo's not terribly fattening, by the way. It's the other things that are fattening are etouffee. Etouffee is full of butter. It's a wonderful dish. Jambalaya is wonderful, but it's full of rice. It's all rice. Things like that. You have some great, very rich foods in Louisiana and the desserts. Oh my goodness. But we never ate them. We never overindulged. It wasn't normal to do that. Now it's perfectly normal.
I should add here for the listener also that you're a food lover and that you have been writing a blog for years on food and recipes.
Yes. Thank you. My blog is called Parenthetically Speaking. And I write about living in New York City and being a Louisiana person. So it naturally covers a lot of food. I've been writing lately about my book, of course, but really is a lot of recipes. And I've compiled my recipes I actually have a first stage of a cookbook done. And that cookbook focuses on the food that's mentioned in my memoir.
I can't wait to see it. I'm looking forward to that.
So I have those recipes, many of them in this new cookbook.
I wanted to go back to, you're talking about growing up being a gay boy in this culture. And there's a really poignant scene when you talk about being 15 years old and your first job at the National Grocery Store. And I wondered if I could read a sentence from the book that you said that I thought really captured this turning point in your life, I thought.
Do it.
Okay. You're talking about, being at this grocery store and this interaction with this the meat man at the grocery store. And you say, I felt a sense of dread that my life was not going to be as easy as it was for all those other people in the world who, since time immemorial, have had this aspect of their lives neatly laid out before them.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk about that and what was happening for you as a 15-year-old there.
Well, I don't know when you, as a gay man, started realizing this very point, which is we're mm-hmm. not like everybody else, and it's not going to be as easy for us. At first, there's a lot of curiosity and confusion, but then you start forming as 15, you start beginning to go, wait a minute, you don't automatically go out and get married. Marriage wasn't in our emotional vocabulary. It wasn't until we got gay married just a few years ago. So we, as gay people, did not even have that to talk about. People talked about it in jokes, the whole thing was just so far-fetched for us. Not that we didn't want it, but we weren't entitled to it. So we worked around it. And so I remember being 15 and go, wait a minute, I'm not going to have all that. I'm not going to have babies necessarily. I'm not going to have a house with a picket fence in the suburbs. We're not welcome there. So I remember how that struck me as being, oh, wait, this is not just my home life I have to get through. Now I have to get on the outside of all this, and here it comes. Although that chapter, The Meat Man, was really, to me, there's a lot of titillation. First discovery of that, wait, this can be fun. It's not scary. Let's let it happen. You know, it's not all gloom, doom. It's really something that's, there's a lot of joy in being. I'm very proud and happy to be gay. And, you know, gay pride is not a misnomer for a lot of us. A lot of us have been forced to live in the closet over the decades and decades or eons of our existence. But I actually enjoy it. I actually enjoy being a gay person. I think we have a lot of fun, and I think there's a lot. Not that we're recruiting, because that's a good straight talking point. Oh, they're recruiting. We don't recruit. We have plenty without having to recruit. But there's a lot of joy in this life, and it's not a lifestyle. It's a life. It's not a style. It's just the way who we are. It's in our DNA, literally, I think. So realizing that very point was hard for me. But then I'm glad I accepted it. It's like, okay, then now what? I have to figure it out. I have to, I have to find a way around it. Like my grandmother, my mom always said, there's going to be a way around it.
One of the things that, as you're talking, I'm thinking about how you make this really great point towards the end of the book, where you talk about, you realize that happiness is something that you can find between the times that are heartbreaking or that are just difficult.
Yeah.
And it spoke to the culture, and it spoke to what you're just saying about, you know, growing up as someone who's gay. It was just a really profound statement, I thought.
Thank you. I want to leave the reader with that. And people who haven't read the book, there were some people who don't want to read about that kind of hardship for a child. It's an unpleasant thing to read. Again, I think I kept it mercifully short when I described the child abuse. But I really want to get across those wonderful, that joie de vivre. It really is, life is full of great moments that sometimes just buzz on by, and you just think, wait a minute, that was a great day. I had, you know, it's the simplest things. I found the other day a little bat that had fallen out of the tree. I think it came from a tree. It was right near a tree, and the dog was trying to get it. It was flapping around, and I got it away from the dog and put it in the bushes near the tree so that hopefully Mother Nature would get it back where it belonged, or whatever, it would be humanely disappear. I didn't want the dog to get it, but it was a sweet little memory. I'm like, that little bat, I never came that close to a bat. I was touching it to try to get it to get away from the dog. I'm never going to forget that. Life is full of those little moments. This was not a, you know, big birthday cake celebration. This was not seeing Barbara Streisand sing. This was a little bat in the yard. And those little moments, that's what our lives are mostly about. And I think my point is that I want people to take those moments in when they happen. When people say making memories, I don't like that it sounds like you're forcing the memories to happen. I think the best memories are not forced. So that's it. I wanted to leave. And I illustrate that particular point with the story about my papa, Dejean, and me when I was five, and I at the circus, and I couldn't get in because I was too short. I wasn't high enough to go through. So he stayed out of the circus with me, and we walked around the big circus tent while the rest of our family went inside, and we had the best time. That was such a profound embedded memory in me. I never forgot that. Obviously, I wrote about it. But that's the kind of thing, is little things that are not what you're expecting, that lagniappe in life.
I love that. I love that section of the book, too. You have a way of painting pictures with your writing, and I could just imagine you and your grandfather outside the circus. It was great. I wondered if you could talk about The Stone Motel. It's the title of your book, and it's like going back in history when you read about this motel that's in this little town.
Well, when we got there, in the very beginning of the book, I talk about how we drove up one Saturday in May, and my father had just bought. He was running an Esso station. Esso is the precursor to Exxon. Esso stands for Standard Oil, but they spelled it out as ESSO. Yeah, so he worked for Standard Oil after the war, and then he opened opened himself up a little Esso station in Eunice, our hometown. And that's all he thought he was going to ever be. And he thought, I want something more. And then he learned about this little motel 3 miles outside of town that was for sale. And it was a family of daughters, three daughters, and this old couple who had, they were getting up in age and they wanted to sell. And they had been there since before, since the 1920s on that property. It had been a number of different businesses, a lumber yard, a house moving company, a grocery store. And then they had rental houses. It wasn't a motel yet, but the owner's father said, hey, out there in California, they're making these roadside hotels. They're calling them motels. This is the beginning of the motel concept was back in those days. So my parents bought one of those original motels before they became ubiquitous. It was built in the late 1940s, early 1950s. After the Depression, there was a lot of skittishness about doing business, being an entrepreneur after the Depression. A lot of people had nothing to go on, so they started businesses. And so he built his the motel, and it ran it for a few years. But we actually ran it as a family longer than he did. We had it for 30 years. They only had it for, I think, maybe 20 years. Fewer than 20 years. So as far as a motel, they had the land and, like I said, other businesses there. So we buy into this, all this history, and it's a little roadside motel already set up, but it had aged and we needed to do a lot of work. And what made it successful for us as a family, made it doable, was that we could all do parts of the work. Laundry, yeah. Cutting the grass. There was lots of grass to cut, doing the cleaning the rooms, renting the rooms. We all got to learn our customers. We had regular customers. For many places, it was a no-tell motel, but for all the clients, it was vacationers. Vacationers would come. And then there were offshore oil rig people who would bring their families. So we had three different types of customers. So the no-tell motel customers who would come and they would have their rendezvous and they would be the regular ones. Those were our bread and butter, that one, that group. But then we'd have these families that would stay in our kitchenettes, because the father would go offshore and work for 2 or 3 weeks outshore, and the family would stay in the motel. And we would, as kids, we befriended all the kids in those families. So we had all these coming and going children in our lives in the motel. So the motel was named Stone Motel because the motel was covered with that stone facade siding that came out of Baltimore in that time. If you go to the city of Baltimore, you see a lot of this motel. This motel type stone. It was made by a company called Formstone. And they would come in and put that up on the side of the building. They would install it, basically. It wasn't like something you'd staple on. It was actually wet, and it involved putting up a lath and installing it and painting these blocks. And it all looked very surreal as it was happening, apparently, because I got a description of the process from one of the daughters. And then it got painted and then looked like these stones were really kind of real in a fake way, you know?
The picture is great in the book, of the vintage postcard you have of the motel itself.
Yeah, well, thank you. That postcard came from the night of the fire. There's a chapter in the book about the fire. A lot of our rooms were, like I said, were lost. There was a box of postcards that was destroyed and water damaged and smoked up. And that postcard that's on the cover started out in that box. I have a perfect one, and I have one that's smoke damaged, and that's the one that's smoke damaged is the one that was used on the cover. My partner, Auburn, designed the cover. And he took it, and he took that photo and made it even darker and more ominous looking because the Stone Motel as a title wasn't really originally the title. University Press of Mississippi asked me to change it about a month before we went to press. And I was like, what? The original title was called The Canasta Summers because in those summers, most of the book...
Part one of the book.
Yeah, most of the book takes place in the summer. And so when I had to change the title, I went, well, I don't have any stories that happened in the fall. I went to have a couple, but really most of it's summertime incidents. And so had I written the book at Stone Motel from the get-go, I would have put more in round year-round type of story, because I had a lot of stories I could have told about being in school, because in school I was a different kid.
Well, you know, you really do weave in the stories of some of these characters. I guess that's the way I kind of viewed them, who came and stayed in the motel. And your experiences living in the house, you know, the family house that's right there next to the motel.
Yeah. Well, it was a palace to us. My father was running an Esso station. My mother had a beauty shop. We were small town people. And we had a big flat ranch style wooden house in the middle of the town. And our family was just growing too big to accommodate. That house was too small to accommodate us. So my dad was looking at this motel purchase as a pragmatic thing. We need a bigger space. We need a business. That's all I know. So he bought this motel and we were all going to be part of it and succeed. And he did succeed largely over the course of the 30 years that we were there. It ended kind of sad because we couldn't sell the motel. He couldn't sell the motel because the economy was bad at the time. And so the value of the motel for us was that it gave us a very rich life over the course of the 30 years that we had it. And rich being rich in experiences, we never had a whole lot of money. The motel did provide for us, and including my mom's beauty shop, like I said, she got us through the fire period. And so that motel was very prominent. It was like in the prologue, I mentioned that it's kind of like another character, another family member was the motel itself. So it was a good title. It's a good title for the book. But again, it's the Canasta Summers. The reason it was named Canasta Summers is that I had a whole lot more about Canasta. It's in the book now, but three of my siblings and me, Gilda and Glenda and my brother Dickie and I, the four of us played Canasta in the middle of all our chores. In the middle of those summers, we would run out and clean rooms, we would cut the grass, we would do the laundry, we'd rent the rooms, and then we'd stay around the dining room table playing Canasta. And Canasta is a game you can get up from and leave and just don't touch the cards and come back and play it for 3 days, the same round. We did that a lot. And so that's why it was originally called the Canasta Summers. And when my siblings and I talk about those years, we talk about them as our Canasta Summers. So that title makes emotional sense to me. And the Stone Motel is, like I said, it's also a good title. It's a title my partner came up with. We brainstormed. I gave him about five different combinations of book titles that they could have played with, and they landed on that one and said, "Go for it. Let's go. Let's get this thing to press." So there we are.
I could really relate to the Canasta around the table, because I grew up playing Canasta with my grandmother and my brothers and friends too. And I loved when you described some of the conversations that you and your sisters and brother would have as kids. It was so interesting as you're sitting there playing cards.
Yeah, it was a great space for us. My father was violent. He was not only violent to me, he was violent to some of my other siblings, not all of us, but some of them. So it was kind of a bubble for us. Like my grandparents' house was a bubble for me. Canasta was a bubble for us. We would be playing, and my father recognized, well, when they're playing, they're not out in the streets on the highway, you know, swimming in some weird ditch somewhere, playing, as kids would do. So Canasta kept us all together and accountable, and we would be talking, and we would be civilized. And so they let us play. They would not touch our Canasta games. They would not, you know, so we were really, that was our bubble.
It came across that way. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. In the last part of your book, part two is titled The Elders Depart. And there's a really powerful scene where you and your mom have an outing to the purple peacock. And I think some of your coming out story kind of seems to come into that section. I wondered if you could talk about that.
Yeah, my mother, I used to drive home from either LSU. I went to LSU for undergraduate school, and then a few years later, I went to grad school at the University of Louisiana. At the time I went, it was called USL, University of Southwestern.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I went to grad school there. And when I would drive home on the weekends, I would take my laundry. I'd go into the big industrial strength motel laundry room and do my laundry, get it done. Then I'd dart out of the house and go visit my friends who still lived in Eunice. And so my mother kept joking with me, "Oh, take me, because she'd be left running the front office on a weekend night. My dad would take early naps so that he could stay up later. So she'd take me. So one of these days, I said, one of these days I will. And I thought, I went out one night when she had said that again, and I thought, why don't I take her? So next time when I got home the next day, I told her, "Yeah, next time let's plan to go. I'm going to take you next time." So we went out to the Purple Peacock. Purple Peacock is an institution in Eunice. It used to have this beautiful neon peacock as its sign. It was a gorgeous, gorgeous, classy. It's a dance hall. That's what they called it back then. Big dance hall. And built in the days with live music. And they have real. They had live acts like all kinds of people who started small in the South and went and became national names. Anyway, so she and I went to the Purple Peacock. I said, okay, then come with me. We'll go have a drink at the Peacock. She suggested, let's go to the Peacock. I haven't been there in 20 years. I said, oh, okay. Mm. I thought I was just going to take her with one of my friends. What I would do when I go visit friends, we'd invariably play, guess what, Canasta or some other card game. So I would go out, we'd make cocktails, we'd have snacks, and we'd play for 2 or 3 hours, and I'd go home. Back to the motel, and then, you know, stay there at the motel. The next day, Sunday, we'd have a barbecue. And then I'd go back to grad school or undergrad school, and I'd, you know, drive whatever to either Baton Rouge or to Lafayette. So that was my routine when I came. I didn't come in every weekend. But anyway, so that night we went to the Peacock, and she and I are talking, and she's really revealing to me. Again, my reporter's hat is on. So I'm asking her questions. I didn't want to talk about me and my life. I want to talk about her. So I was leading the questions, and I didn't have a recorder with me, and she knew that I took notes. But she was very open, and she said her recurring line was, I can't wait until we sell this place, that place one day. She was so tired of the motel. It was wearing her out. It was around the clock. It is around the clock business. And so it was wearing her out. And so I'd asked her, you know, she divulged to me and a couple of my other siblings at the time, she would have left my father. She saw his violence. She saw how hard life was, and she wanted something else for her. But she's a mother, so she had 9 children. She wasn't about to be selfish like that. And we kept telling her, do it. You need to be, you deserve happiness. So we had a conversation about happiness, and about, I said, one day you can come live with me, and we'll, you can stay with me. And then after that, you can live with one of the other siblings, and, you know, you don't have to worry about it. You know, you'll be taken care of. And she said, okay, well, as soon as I'm there in the motel with him, and then I go visit my mom, my grandmother, Hortense, Mama, I go visit her. And so she had those needs to stay in touch with her mother. She knew that if she left, she would still have to have those regular trips to my grandmother's house. So, but I could tell that she wanted it. But she talked to me about my life. And it's when she asked me, we never had a coming out because, you know, if you're a little boy and your father already knows you're going to be a gay man, he was already, you know, but the violence there did not let me have what I like to call my little gay quinceañera. I did not get to come out at 15 and have a celebration about it. Not that a lot of gay people do. A lot of people, it's fraught. It's not an easy thing. So when a person comes out, it takes a lot out of a lot of people. So I never had that moment. It was kind of understood already. But we talked about it. And I remember her buying a book about homosexuality, and the book had that term in its title, and it was a very academic little almost clinical book, and I thought, well, she's good for her. It was titillated by the book. I looked through it and I was like, oh, it's very kind of scholarly. I wasn't that
clinical, probably. Yeah.
But she bought this little book, and it told me that she was genuinely, like, she was all of us, she was genuinely interested in me. And it turns out I have another brother who's gay as well, so there are two of us in the nine. And so she was educating herself on that. I never had to say, you know, I'm gay, mom. She just kind of, that night at the Peacocks, we were talking about, we were joking, and we each had a Tom Collins and some cigarettes, and neither one of us really smoked.
I loved how you told that story, the Tom Collins and cigarettes, with your mother.
Yeah, so we were puffing and coughing, and, you know, it's not really, it's just like, ran in the lounge, a dance hall. It wasn't booming with people yet. We went early, and of course, there's nobody there but the bartender and a waitress. So we drank and talked and smoked for about 2 hours, and we had this great conversation that meandered. But one of the parts that you alluded to is that she talked to me about happiness, about I want to know about you and you know, how are you doing emotionally? Are you romantically? You know, she wanted to know. She wanted to pry without being too prying. And I said, well, let me ask you advice. How did you pick up dad? And she told me all about how. How did you meet dad? How did that happen? And she told me all about that, which became fodder for one of the chapters. So she told me about her history with that. And that led to how am I doing in that realm? How am I going to meet somebody? And she said, I said, mom, so what do you think I should do? She goes, well, when you go out, and I told her where we'd go out and dance clubs and this, that, and the other.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
So she'd say, well, when you go out, dress like the man you want to go home with. And I was like, wow, isn't that good? You know, it's like,
that's great advice. Yeah.
A lot of opposites attract. So a tattooed, pierced up guy might fall for a banker. I know that happens, but the good advice is if you want to go home with somebody who's going to have some future with some potential, try to find somebody who you can tell is going to be similar to you. And that's immediately apparent in the way they dress. That's what she meant behind that dress like the man you want to go home with, which was so well put. I was like, damn, I'm going to do that. And I did. So, and I've always used that. And she also told me, she was good. She had great lines as a mother, as many mothers do. She said, once when I was much younger, I was very vain, and it was January, and Louisiana does get cold. On occasion, so I was running out, and I had at the time thick red hair, auburn hair, and I was very conscientious about keeping my hair in place, and so I didn't want to put a hat on. She goes, she just put a hat on. I was like, I'm just going to so and so, you know, whatever, and she says, there's no hat ugly as vanity. And
I was like, love that.
Yeah. I know. So thank you, Mom.
Morris, you have jewels like that sprinkled through the book. These sayings are just amazing. From your, you know, your mother and my mare. Well, Morris, I'm looking at the time, and I think I've taken up enough of your time today, but I just want to thank you. It's been wonderful to talk to you. It's just such a wonderful book.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I am so glad that the podcast is on, and that's a thing. I hope lots of people are reached and come into the conversation about what happens to queer people in the South. It's not something that there's a lot of content out there now that's emerging, but a concerted conversation about that, I think, is going to be very much welcome and needed. So I'm so thrilled to be part of it.
Me too. But stay tuned, everyone, for Voices of the Queer South future podcasts.